This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions. They make your memories last forever. Dr. Gary Walton, dentistry with a personal touch. And Mars Insurance and Financial Services, keeping it simple.
He might not be one of Indiana's best-known sports figures, but he sure had a knack for making history. Growing up in near poverty in a single-parent home in Harlem, he was heading nowhere in particular until a chance meeting at the YMCA with one of the all-time legendary figures in sports propelled him toward a new life. Despite playing just one season of high school basketball, he managed to earn a college scholarship, and with an assist or two from fate, wound up as the captain of one of the most historic of all the NCAA championship teams. Not just for winning the title with a stunning comeback victory, but for playing a role in breaking down social barriers as well. 4 years later, he left a rare opportunity in corporate America to take the risk of trying out for the first Indiana Pacers team in the American Basketball Association. He beat the odds to earn a roster spot and went on to hit one of the most memorable game-winning shots in the history of basketball. He later achieved first in Indianapolis as a media member and civic leader and stands today as one of the most influential role models in the city. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Jerry Harkness.
Oh, yeah.
Jerry, let's start at the beginning. I know you grew up in Harlem. Tell me about your life there, what it was like for you as a kid growing up in Harlem.
Well, you probably heard this story before because it's told by a lot of people growing up in the inner city. We were in poverty a lot. My mom was a single parent. She worked her heart out. She was dedicated to my sister and I. And we struggled, but there was a lot of love in the family. There was a lot of stress on her that she even went to Bellevue Hospital. I owe a lot to her. But I started playing a little basketball around in the community, and I started into sports. I started running track. And there were days that we didn't eat or we had just bread. I remember having bread and syrup. There were some really tough times. But during that time, my mind focused on sports, and I wish it had focused on my schoolwork a little better. But sports, and I was a person that didn't skip school or things like that. It was just a little tougher for me to get the grades that I needed to move on. But we worked hard. We had to struggle, and sometimes I think that has helped me. It kind of builds your character when you come from a troubling background, and you got to hustle and work hard for everything, and you can't take a meal for granted. So that's on your mind, and little things are on your mind, like I had holes in my shoes, and I'm trying to hide it. And on rainy days, boy, that's tough, and you put cardboard in there, and that soaks up, and you're trying not to let your classmates see the cardboard soaking up and coming out and things like that. So you're worrying about that and your grades, but there's a lot of things on your mind. You're not sure when you're going to eat at night. Things like that. So all of that, I think, played a part in my development, in my character for later on in life.
Now, you mentioned sports. You participated in sports, but you've told me before you really didn't play organized basketball for a while.
No, I didn't. I tried out for my junior high school team, and I just made it. And I sat on the bench, and I saw a little bit of action. But I hadn't developed enough, but at least I made the team, and that was a plus. When I got to high school, after the junior high school, I was kind of scared. I had so many disappointments in my life, so I wanted to try out for the team, but all of the guys on there were kind of from uptown. I was in another location in Harlem, and I just didn't have the courage to go out for the team early on. So I kept on playing outside. I moved from Harlem to the Bronx to the projects. So there was a team called the Clowns that I played for, and we traveled around playing at community centers and throughout Harlem and the Bronx and things like that. So, and I developed, I got really good, and I kind of led my team. But I learned teamwork a lot playing with the guys. So it was a beginning, but I did not really start out playing. I was scared to try out. We had an intramurals also at DeWitt Clinton, my high school. And in my junior year, I did very well in intramurals, but I still was worried about going out. So I happened to be just shooting around at the Harlem YMCA because I did go play in a lot of different locations, but not organize high school ball. And there was a guy that was going through, and I was shooting and doing little fakes with myself. And he came over and told me, you know, you're not that bad. And I looked up to him, and I'll never forget that. My mouth flew open. And he said, you know, you could do something like that, or you could get a scholarship like that. And he walked on. But this guy had been a hero in my life, and just for him to give me those words of encouragement, I moved on. And I tried out for the team, even though I was scared. And long story short, I made the team. I worked hard and made the first team. Then I was the leading scorer with the center. We both were average around 15 points a game, about the same, and through the year. And then here I am in Madison Square Garden, and I had a real good game against Morris High School, and I set a record. I think I hit 13, 14 free throws in a row, and we beat Morris. Then we played against Boys High, and we upset them. So here I am, starting from scratch, really, and won it all. I mean, that's the city championship in New York is just huge because there's so many schools. It's not like it's almost similar to the state championship here in Indiana. But those words of encouragement started my career, and the guy's name was Jackie Robinson.
So let's go back. You know, Jackie Robinson just says a few words of encouragement to you at the YMCA one day. And from that, you decided to go out for the team. That gave you enough confidence to go out for the high school team your senior year?
That was the edge. I had done well in the intramurals, but I still was on the line. Should I go out? People were telling me you should go out. And I just didn't. I still was worried about not making it more than making it. And that might come strange, but like I indicated, I had so many disappointments in my life, so that I wanted to hold that. And he was the one that pushed it over the top. This guy, who was my idol, I mean, he was way up there, nobody close. He was just everything I wanted to be as a person, as far as sports is concerned, or as a person in general.
This would have been in 1958 or something like that when you met him at the Y, because you graduated from high school in 59, I believe. At that time, is it possible for you to put into words what Jackie Robinson meant, not just to you, but to other people in Harlem?
Mark, the thing about this, and this is one of the positives of segregation, and to put it that way, there are not many. You would see these guys in Harlem walking up and down. Your doctors were right there. All of your lawyers, Bill Robinson, the tap dance, you going, Duke Ellington, I mean, James Baldwin was in my time. So any type of area, you had them right there in Harlem or in Brooklyn. So you walk up to them, you see them, they go by you. Joe Louis, I mean, when he came to town and so on. So you, Ray Robinson, Roy Camp, I mean, these guys were there, and you could touch them like. And you could talk to them from time to time. How you doing, Jackie? Or as they go down the street, because they couldn't live anywhere else. The segregation was in full effect at the time. So all your doctors couldn't move to the suburbs. They lived right there with you. And they were your role models right close. And that's probably one of the downfalls of integration, because then they started, all your heroes started to moving out and things. But that, to be there, that's why I ran into a Jackie Robinson. because he was in the neighborhood. He was always around someplace. Well, he was that way anyway. I probably, even if we were integrated at the time, I think a Jackie Robinson would have still been coming to the Harlem Boys Club because of the caliber of person he was. I don't know if any of the others, but I know Jackie would have been.
Did you ever have a chance to talk to Jackie Robinson after you had made it, so to speak, as a professional basketball player?
Mark, I had a chance. I was home, I think, and he was with Chuck Full of Nuts, I believe, and I was on 34th Street, and he was walking. I couldn't do it, and it hurts me to this day. It really, and I was right behind him. I could see his pigeon toes and everything walking down, and he was with Chuck Full of Nuts at the time, and I just happened to be downtown, and I just couldn't do it. I was nervous and scared. I couldn't do it.
Harkness leads Loyola to the NCAA championship and breaks down some social barriers in the process when one-on-one continues. Welcome back to One-on-One with Mark Monteith. It took a fluky set of circumstances that Jerry Harkness wound up with a scholarship to Loyola of Chicago and made good on it.
Okay, so you have a productive senior season at DeWitt Clinton, but we need to get you off to college and move the story along because you still have a lot of history to make. First, because you are a city track champion as a distance runner, you earn a track and field and cross-country scholarship to St. John's, but your grades aren't good enough, and you don't qualify for that. So you have to go to summer school, and you continue to play summer league basketball, and you're playing against people that the Indiana basketball fans are very familiar with, such as Roger Brown, Connie Hawkins, Larry Brown, and Donnie Walsh. And based on your play there, NYU offers a basketball scholarship, but you failed the entrance exam, so you're still stuck. And meanwhile, your AAU coach, a man named Walter November, he keeps working on your behalf and gets you a scholarship at Texas Southern. But before you can start school there, the dormitory burns down, and so that's out. But finally, a coach from Loyola of Chicago takes notice of you in the summer league play and gives you a chance. So you're off to Loyola, and there you work hard, you get your grades up, you begin to excel on the basketball court, and you're selected a team captain for your senior season. And that brings us to 1963, a distant era in more ways than one, because the story now goes well beyond the basketball court. Your coach at Loyola, a man named George Ireland, has built the team by breaking some of the unwritten rules of college basketball at the time, primarily by starting four black players, and this being a time when no other school was daring to play more than three blacks at any one time during a game. So were you guys treated any differently because of that?
Yeah, we had some problems. When we went to Houston, we had a problem. We were beating Houston really bad. And I can still see us coming through the corridor, and they're throwing things on them. My team is red hot. Your team is all black and throwing things out. We had things like that, and then when we left and we won the game, we should have been much better, but the pressure, we should have beat them worse than what we did. But the pressure was so much on us like that. So we had an idea when we played and went to certain places. So that was one time. Even when we left and went to a place to eat, we couldn't eat there. We had to get up. So we got on up, and we were kind of, I'll never forget, I was so upset, and I hear Ron Miller, one of the guys, you heard the guy, let's get on out of here. Now, and I almost got a little mad at him. So so it was just that stress and thing. We had already won the game, but just under those conditions. We went to New Orleans, and when we went to New Orleans, we knew how it was going to be. The white players, as soon as we got to the airport to take cabs, the white players got in a cab, and they went to the hotel. Well, we couldn't stay there, so we stayed with people in the community, a minister and so on. And ironically enough, that was probably one of our best times. That entire community came to us. We had cake and food and bands and parade on our behalf. And we went and played Loyola of New Orleans, and we were just so fired up. And then we won by 30 or 40 and something like that. So, and we had so much talent. But, yeah, there was at that time, you didn't see four black players. Maybe Michigan had three, which Oliver Darden, Cassie, and Bill Button are the thing. But most of the places we played, like Duke didn't have any. We played Art Heyman and them. We had some problems in at Marshall in Huntington, but that was on the court. We, the verbal abuse for some of the players that we had. But, yeah, we had a lot of that, but only when we went to places where it was strongly segregated.
Yeah. We'll jump ahead to the NCAA tournament because this is a historical event, really. Mississippi State that year, Mississippi State had refused to compete in the tournament in 59, 61, and 62 because they had a policy of not competing against black players. But in 63, they won the SEC championship. They were ranked sixth in the country. And their university president, a man named Dean Colvard, says, we are going to compete this year. We're going to get away from this segregation thing. But a state senator, I guess, obtained an injunction prohibiting the team from leaving the state. So the president had the team, like at midnight, under the cover of darkness, drive across the state boundary into Tennessee, and then they caught a flight out to Nashville the next morning to compete in the NCAA tournament. And now, inevitably, they were going to meet up with you guys. So I know I went back and looked. You beat Tennessee Tech. Loyola beat Tennessee Tech 111-42 in the opener. You guys had a balanced team because all five of your starters scored between 17 and 21 points in that game. And then 4 nights later, you play Mississippi State. What do you remember from that game?
The one thing that I'll always remember, and I think deep down we knew this was something special, but our minds as young guys wasn't on that. We wanted to win the game, and we thought of things along that line. The scouting reports was on our mind and all like that, so we really didn't get into what this meant until right before the game starts. I'm the captain, and I go out to shake hands, and I shook the captain, Jovan Gold's hand, and the place lit up. There were so many flash bulbs going pop, 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 pop all over the place. And I, after shaking his hand, I looked him in his eye, and he looked at me, and I smiled, and he gave a little smile. And right then I knew that this was something special. This is history. I mean, that place just blew up with light bulbs. And later on, you get all of the what it meant, what it was about. And I, later on, I put my hats off to Mississippi, the coach.
Babe McCarthy was your coach.
McCarthy, who I had, who played in the ABA, coached with New Orleans. But, man, they did something really, a lot of courage. And see, you're right, they had to sneak out. What they did is they had Babe McCarthy, and the governor, Ross Barnett, was going to serve the injunction. And he snuck out. And then the president snuck to Nashville, like you said. And so they tried to... So what they did, they went to the airport, some of the players, and they went to the airport, the reserves and the trainers and all that, to check and see what was going on. Nobody was there, so they called the other guys, and they raced to the airport, got on the plane. And some of the guys were in tears when they made it and they got on the plane. We are going to play this game. They were so happy that they are finally going to play in the NCAA.
When you guys beat Tennessee Tech so badly in that opener, Babe McCarthy was there, and he said something like, I wish we'd stayed home because nobody can beat a team like that. So he knew he was up against something, and Loyola did beat Mississippi State, 61-51. You dominated the boards. Your next game was against Illinois, which had won the Big Ten Championship. You won that by 15 points, and you, by the way, had 33 points. 33 points for Harkness. Then you beat Duke, 94-75, and that takes you to the final game of the NCAA tournament. You play Cincinnati, which was ranked number one in the country and had won the NCAA tournament the two previous years in 61 and 62. So this is obviously a great matchup, a great showdown. Cincinnati's lineup included a couple familiar names. Ron Bonham had been Mr. Basketball out of Muncie. Tom Thacker would later play in the NBA and for the Pacers. He was on that Cincinnati team. Loyola was the highest scoring team in the country, I guess, whereas Cincinnati played a more deliberate half-court style. So this is a classic matchup. From what I understand, Tom Thacker, who was a great defensive player, guarded you, and you didn't get a field goal until there was less than 5 minutes left in the game. Cincinnati built a 15-point lead in that game with like 14 minutes to go. They're trying to stall. You're pressing to come back. Loyola gradually makes a comeback. You hit a field goal with like 4 seconds left to force overtime. Is that right?
That's correct. But I'll never forget, I hit a basket, and we're still down one. And I found a guy named Larry Shingleton, who's from Indiana as well, not knowing he's a 95% free throw shooter. I mean, that I didn't know, didn't care. They're up, they're down. I mean, it's something 8, 12 seconds or something like that to go. And we had him in the backcourt, and I just fouled him. And he went to the line. He hits the first, which is, to me, always the hard one, you know, 95%. But I started edging away. I was right behind the foul line on the side, and Hunter got the rebound and flipped it to Miller. Well, I had taken off, and Miller threw the ball to me, and I had a 12-footer or so in the corner to tie the ball game. The place went wild. The momentum changed back to us. So when we hit the basket to put it in overtime, I sneak again on jump ball, assuming that Hunter is going to win it on the first one, and they give me a long pass after we get the ball, boom, and I get a layup. We go up for the first time. Then it goes back and forth. So we slowed it down with about, I guess, 45 seconds to go. I was supposed to take the shot. So we're passing it around, and with about 10 to go, I go to the basket, and I go up, and Ron Bonham tips it a little bit. He was guarding me at the time. And I didn't feel good on the shot. And you got to think of all these things in your mind, but that quick, you don't have much time, a split second. And I saw Hunter in the corner. He was getting ready to go for the basket, but he was slow and going, so I threw it to him. He took the shot and missed, but Rouse was on the other side to tip it in, and we won the NCAA championship.
Yeah, so Loyola wins the championship off of your kind of tipped ball or whatever, the pass, and Rouse gets a tip in to win the championship. And it, I guess it was regarded as something of an upset. But I wonder, you know, just a few years ago, the Texas Western team that won it 3 years later in 1966 got a huge amount of attention. There was a movie called Glory Road, because that was the first team to have five black starters. Do you feel like Loyola was somewhat overlooked just because you happen to have one white starter in the starting lineup? I mean, did it make that much difference?
I thought our story was better, but I think I don't know if the word America liked, but they like that kind of a black against white. It just seems to be more exciting. I don't know what that is all about or something like that. But our story of what we went through, which was 3 to 4 years before them, and also what Mississippi State did, that could have been put together as really something unique to have them sneak out what we went through and to meet a team like that. The closeness we had on the court, we played so hard against each other, well played game, but there was a respect for them from us, and they showed it for us as well, and we had it for them. And at the end of the game, it was a good game. There was some respect in the eyes when we met their eyes. I mean, I thought that's the story. I really felt that was the story, because you can hit it all. Yeah, and it's a human story, a good human. Maybe that's what we don't like. We like the, okay, here's the five blacks going against them, Kentucky, head off, rough, and all that. But ours was sort of two teams meeting and respecting each other, them sneaking out to play against them, and could have been hurt. Their families could have been hurt, because there were segregationists back there that didn't like the idea. So that in itself is good. And you know, Mark, we find out a lot of things from sports. You could not have told me that the majority of the students at Mississippi State, when they talked to them and had a survey, wanted Mississippi basketball team to play. Mississippi State, they voted for them to play. At Mississippi, and all we saw in the press and how they were, and the sports brought that out, the difference. You say, oh my goodness, these guys are all right. You could not, I would have thought that 90 to 95% of Mississippians were racist. I mean, from what I know, I only read the media, and I see the Klan, and I see the fighting. I thought all of them were that way. But it takes basketball sometimes, and you see two teams from two different parts of the country playing for the very first time against each other and getting along great and playing within the rules and enjoying it. That's what basketball will do.
Do you look back at that Loyola team and think it was just fateful, that somehow it was meant to be?
Yes. I always believed that. That's why I didn't go to Texas Southern or NYU. I believe I was made to go to Loyola. That was such a team. It's the best team I've ever been a part of. You know, it's hard to explain what a team that was.
Jerry Harkness becomes a member of the first Indiana Pacers team, and with one fling of his left arm, makes more history when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One with Mark Monteith. We're talking with Jerry Harkness, who, after leading Loyola to the NCAA championship in 1963, took a major risk to try out for the first Indiana Pacers team.
Well, to this day, Loyola is the only college from the state of Illinois to win a championship and the only Jesuit school to win an NCAA championship. So you still have, all these years later, you know, something to hang your hat on that nobody else can claim. But let's go from there. You're, like you said, you're an All-American Loyola. You're a second-round draft pick of the Knicks. You played briefly for the Knicks. Then you wind up back in Chicago working for Quaker Oats. And people may not appreciate that now, but at that time, for a black person to be working in corporate America was quite unusual.
Well, I was the first salesman, black salesman for Quaker Oats. And I was the 11th person picked in the draft, which is strange because they didn't have that many teams. I always thought and always think that I was put here to do certain things in life. And the break color barriers and maybe with the Jackie Robinson, all of that connects with me. So I'm the first black with Quaker Oats. Then I leave Quaker Oats, which they really was disappointed, but I had to try out again after not making it with the Knicks. I had to try out. And then it was Indianapolis. That was the closest, and me and Hunter. So Hunter, I said, I'm going to try out too because he didn't make it. And he went to the Minnesota team, Huskies or what have you, and I went to I tried out. And it was not easy for me.
Listen, let's set this up. You got a good job in Chicago in corporate America. You hear about this new basketball league, the American Basketball Association, forming, and there's a team in Indianapolis, and this is 1967. So you've been with Quaker Oats, I guess, a couple of years. What motivated you to take this risk of leaving a good corporate job to go to this league where nobody knows if it's going to last or not? You know, you'd go down to Indianapolis to try out for this team. From what I understand, you lived at the Y for a while. You left your family behind in Chicago. Why do that?
I knew in my life that it would become a time where I would say, could I have made it? You know, I just felt that. And I wouldn't have an answer. Could I have played, really, if I had given it another try, could I have played professional basketball? And I said to myself, that would be a question in my life for the rest of my life, and I wouldn't have an answer. So I had to prove to myself, I wanted to, that I could play professional basketball. So I left my family and came down, and I think we all stayed at the Marat Hotel, 25th of Fall Creek there. And I was not in as shape I thought I was in. We started doing the little suicide runs. I threw up. I'd say I got dizzy and everything. And I still had a name from the Loyola and the national championship, and it was 2 or 3 years later, but I was an NC All-American. So I'll never forget Staberman taking me and said, look, you're not in shape.
This is Larry Staberman, the coach.
Yes, the first coach. He says, you know, we're going to take a chance with you. And we're going to be up at Rensselaer. We're going to put you with that group. Because they had hundreds of guys out there. They had 64 guards and all that. And I wasn't in shape. I wasn't winning the sprints and so on. I said, thank you. We had about a week. I worked out, swam at the Y where guys were going out socializing. And they, I ran and everything. When I got to Rensselaer in that little bit of time, I was getting there anyway. On the sprints, I was number one. I was the fastest, and I started shooting. I really worked hard and still was one of the last. Me and Rail and a couple of others were the last one. So I was the one of the last. I finally got a shirt. Now, that was it. I finally, and I was one of the last guys picked. I'll never forget, I went into the little locker room where nobody was there and cried like a baby. I'll never forget that as long as I live.
Up in Rensselaer, you mean?
Yeah, because that I had made the team. I was one of the last ones to make it. And, boy, that just was, that was one of the greatest feelings in my life. Winning the national championship was the best, but that was close.
Yeah, well, you took such a huge chance to do it, so it's quite an accomplishment. Do you recall your salary from that first year?
Yeah, $16,000, and that was good money in 67, but still I had to go, and I got a summer job. So when it finished, I was in the 20s. So can you imagine a professional basketball? I had to get a summer job to get 20 grand or more. But that's the way it was. But I lived well on that, and we did well, and my family moved up here. And the rest is history. I really had a success here in Indianapolis.
Absolutely. So 15 games into your first season, you're playing in Dallas. John Beasley hits a shot with just a couple seconds to go to put them up by 1 point, by two points. The ball's inbounded to you, and you just heave the ball the length of the court and hit it. And I, from what I understand, still the longest shot in the history of basketball, at least the history of professional basketball. It was described as a 92-footer. I think it really was probably 88 feet because the court's, you know, not that long. Yeah, the goals are inside the inlines, but you hit this game-winning three-pointer from like 88 feet, and this is one of the things you're known for today, obviously.
Yeah, it gives me a few banquets to go to. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been asked to go to them. Yeah, I took the ball from Oliver Darden, and Beasley had just scored, and it was a couple of seconds. He gave it to me. I couldn't even move hardly, and I'm not sure if I took a step, and I was right by their basket, right underneath, and I pulled it back, and I let it go as hard as I could towards the basket, and the place was still cheering from Beasley's shot, and I could see Cliff Hagan and all those guys, and I could see from the bench also, and this thing flashed back to me, the Pacers with their heads down, getting ready to stand up, and I'm the only one, I felt, looking at the ball. After I looked, and it started to come down, I said, it's going towards the basket. It hits the backboard and go in. And the place, from the screaming and yelling, and it wasn't a lot of people there, but yeah, they hit a shot with 2 seconds ago. And they screaming and yelling, and it got silent. I never forget that. Everything was silent. And the referees started to get with each other, and I went over, and Neto could tell me, please let it be good, please, 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 and they counted it, and we got ready for the overtime. I'll never forget that.
Thinking it was a two-pointer.
And the league came up with that three-point shot, and even at that, you're not thinking, and with the bank, it was a three-point shot, and it won the ball game.
Jerry Harkness builds a life after basketball and blazes a few more trails when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One with Mark Monteith. We're talking with former Pacer Jerry Harkness, who, after completing his basketball career, still found ways to lead.
So you finished the first season with the Pacers and then came back the second year. at the start of the season, there was a coaching change. Slick Leonard replaced Larry Staverman early in the season. But 19 games into that season, in early December, you were basically forced to retire.
Yeah, Mark, what happened is I had a back injury, and I was having a really good year. I was reserve coming off the bench, and I was averaging 10 points a game and shooting better than the first year. I felt good. I was in even better shape and really ready to go. But I jerked and wiggled, and I felt something give. And it had happened earlier, but I worked it back. But my back went out while I was on the road. And I worked to get it back. But I was playing tentatively because I was afraid it might go back out. And I'll never forget Slick put me on the line to go with Bobby Hooper and a couple other guards. And I took my time because I didn't want it to go out. And the guys came up ahead of me. And I was faster than them. But he made a decision there from those guys that he'd stay with them. And my back would not have made it anyway. I know that. It had kept going out. And my knees, I'm trying to take pressure off my knees and my back go out. So the decision was so much better for me. And you don't think of it at the time. Oh, darn it, I'm faster than those guys. I'm quicker. I'm having 10 points a game. I'm coming off. And I'm having a good year. But things work for the better. At least in my life. I go back and look at me trying to get to college, NYU, I didn't make it, Texas Southern, the dorm burns down, and you get down on yourself, and you know, what? Why me? What's going on here? St. John's, my grades aren't good, I could go there, and I'm out of it. But when you look back, maybe somebody upstairs was looking after me because they said, no, you're going to go to Loyola because I got something there for you. And you win a national championship. The same holds true with finally, I went to Indianapolis. I proved that I could play professional basketball, and I have an injury. I'm finished there. My career, that as far as the man upstairs, I got some other things for you. I got Black Expo. I want you to play a part in that. I want you to break the color line with the United Way. I want you to break the color line at Channel 13 as a sportscaster. And that was for me. And I accept that with happiness, you know, that I was able to do those things, you know. And that, sometime I think that was my job to do, not to go with Mike Storen and get into general manager type positions or coaching and so on. So I came back and did these things and things that have made me happy at the United Way and the social work activities and things like that. I've been blessed. I really have. When you think of all that it's done for me, sports and hitting that shot, I have been blessed. I've come a long way. And it was something I could have gotten into coaching or scouting, and I'll never forget Mike Storen got me into scouting a little bit at the end and was going to the Kentucky Colonels and asked me if I wanted to go, maybe I can get some management. And I, for some reason, I said, no, I would like it here in Indianapolis.
After you left the Pacers, after you were kind of forced into retirement by the injuries, you worked for Channel 13. You were the first Black sportscaster in the state. Did you take that on as out of a sense of obligation, so to speak, or was it something you really wanted to do? Why did you go that direction?
I think it's something I wanted to be in the limelight. I had been in the limelight all my life. I'm going to tell you the truth. So I enjoyed. That was a chance for me to be in the limelight again and also stay with basketball that I didn't want to give up completely. And so the opportunity came here again because Channel 13 didn't have any Blacks. And they were under pressure right away. And here I'm leaving the Pacers, and they're interviewing me. And evidently the interview was pretty good. And that's when they asked me, would you like, you think, come with Channel 13? I said, yeah. And I was awful at first. I mean, I got to be mediocre from awful. I mean, I just was not. I was scared to death. And I think being the first really played a part. It got me even more nervous. And plus, I was doing it part-time and running from United Way. And even at one time, I had a job at WTLC in the morning, a sports show. And then I'd move and go to United Way, and then on the weekends I'd do sports. And I didn't give myself a chance. Number one, I could have been better. I'm not sure if I would have been up there where I could have gone national or something. I just didn't have that talent. That was not my talent. That's okay. There were things that I did good. So. And there are things that I wasn't, but I was willing to try anything like that. But I think the pressure also of me being the first black, and I wanted to do well so much because I felt represented. And then I started to feel the way Jackie felt. And then I got into the community, and I played a key role. I was in the first committee that started Black Expo. I just got into the community, and people, what is he doing? Some of the blacks even thought that I might be an FBI infiltrator, because here's a guy coming from the Pacers and getting into the nitty-gritty of the community and working in the community. You're trying to get something positive for black people, and you wonder, and they wondered about me. So I had to deal with all phases of the black community, and that includes the Panthers and all of the other groups, the radical groups and all that. But I am more proud of that, because I look at Black Expo and what it's done, and to know that you were on the ground floor and played a big role at that time and the development of Indiana Black Expo, and I played a big part in it. And I'm really proud. Those are some of the things. That's why I think I didn't go to Kentucky. That's why I stayed here. Then I went to the United Way, and I was the first black and that professional fundraiser here in the state. So I think that was my role to be played. And sometimes you're put there some way. I don't know. And I did some coaching and I coached kids. And then I got with the 100 Black Men and did mentoring and working in the schools. And I think that was my role in life. Even to this day, I'm still in that. And then maybe it'll be some other things for me as I move on. I'm still young at 68. But then I got into the business world and struggled through that. But the United Way, we started minority programs, and I played a key role. They were huge successes. So I had some things where I wasn't that good at and some things I was pretty good at. So, but I don't know if that matters, is what the outcome is and what does it do for the future of the community. And I think I did a lot of things in that respect.
Yeah. Do you ever wonder how your life, and as you just talked about, the lives of many others, would be different if Jackie Robinson hadn't given you those few words of encouragement back at the Harlem Y all those years ago?
I was motivated anyway. I probably would have been, and I'm proud, I would have been proud of that. I probably would have been a postman or something like that, because I wanted to get out. I wanted to get a good job. My father worked on wash windows in the United Nations. I was so proud of him. And, man, he made $100 a week. And we were going, my dad was something. So I would have still been okay, but never would have reached the opportunities I got as a result of basketball.
I'll be back with an amazing story when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I've got one more story before we close. One of the people watching Harkness lead Loyola to that NCAA championship in 1963 was an 18-year-old student at the University of Arkansas Pine Bluff. His name was O.T. Gordon, and he was mesmerized by that comeback victory. That one game helped inspire the young black student from a small town in Arkansas to believe he could achieve something great as well. And he went on to fulfill his dream of becoming a doctor. Now, fast forward nearly 50 years. Gordon is a doctor in Indianapolis at Methodist Hospital. A patient is referred to him, and Gordon's examination reveals the man to have colon cancer. But because it's caught early, surgery is successful, and the patient is healthy today. His name? Jerry Harkness. Just as Jackie Robinson inspired Harkness to pursue a career in basketball, Harkness helped inspire Gordon to pursue a career in medicine. And then Gordon helped save Harkness's life, allowing him to continue the work inspired by Jackie Robinson. Small world, eh? I'll continue the theme of NCAA champions next week with a look at the career of Pete Turgovich. The former East Chicago Washington star led his high school team to an undefeated season and a state championship in 1971, and went on to start for John Wooden's final NCAA championship team at UCLA in 1975. That's next week on One-on-One.